Last week we covered chapter 1 of the book of Micah, and I told you that this week we would cover chapters 2 and 3. We're not going to cover every verse of those chapters, but that is what we're going to focus on. In chapter 1, Micah announced that disaster was coming to Samaria. That came in around the year 722 BC. This is when the big empire of Assyria, what I've been calling the Irish mob, comes in to help the southern kingdom of Judah fight off the attack from the north. And that fall of the northern kingdom is what Micah is grieving at the beginning of chapter 1. But then we get this insight, this window into his own personal grief, because that same disaster is now going to come not just on the northern kingdom, but on his own people in the south. And then he warns the nearby villages to respond in ways that take that disaster seriously. And we talked about how God is portrayed in that opening chapter. He's portrayed in a very frightening way. He values justice over stability, and he's active in bringing about judgment, and he's acutely aware of the facts on the ground. And God has this penchant for poetic justice. In the book of Micah, poetic justice is kind of a big deal. And Micah does not believe that his words are going to bring about any kind of change. This disaster is coming. The question that we kind of left off with was why? Why is this disaster coming? He's preaching about all this coming trouble, so what caused all of that? And there's kind of a vague answer in verse 7 of chapter 1. In verse 5, all this is for the transgression of Jacob. But what that transgression is, isn't made really clear. It becomes clearer in the material that we'll look at today. For Micah, what led to this collapse, this destruction, that other prophets also talk about, but for Micah, what led to it was not false worship. That's Isaiah talks about that. Isaiah is really big on the false worship of the people. But it's not like idolatry for Micah. That's not his big deal. It wasn't like pride or sexual misconduct or a vague sense of moral pollution. For Micah, the fault lies squarely on the shoulders of the leadership, on the kings and the prophets and the wealthy people. And there's a series of problems that we're going to look at that are all like financial and economic in nature. That seems to be Micah's big concern. It's the concrete realities of business and investing and markets and politicking. That's what led to the disaster, if you ask Micah. And so as we're going through the text today, one of the things we'll need to think about is what would Micah condemn today? Where do we see similar kinds of things taking place today? And I'm a little nervous because there's a good chance that it's going to step on toes, that it creates, we'll call it conversation. I've said for the last couple of weeks, the book of Micah doesn't have a clear structure. It's a collection of spoken word oracles that have been preserved in writing. And in chapters 2 and 3, if this will ever go, there are 5 of these oracles. There's actually a 6th one, but it's different from all the others, and we're going to talk about that later. Not this week. But you have these 5 separate oracles, and each one moves in a similar vein. We're going to look at 3 of them specifically. We're going to look at the first one in chapter 2, verses 1 through 7, and then we'll look at the 2 oracles at the beginning of chapter 3. And all of these have a similar flow. They all begin with identifying the offenders. Who is Micah addressing? Is he addressing kings, prophets, business people? Who is he talking to? And then he names their sin. So woe to you, the prophets, because you do this. And that could be one verse, it could be several verses. And then he'll warn of the destruction that's coming to them. And again, that destruction is poetic justice. Something is going to happen specifically to the leaders, not just to the people. And then sometimes, not always, but sometimes we'll get this report of a rejection of the oracle. So I think it's only in 2 out of 5, it ends with some sort of note about how the people that he's addressing don't want to hear it. How are we doing so far? It's just been a lot of me talking. All right. Okay, oracle number 1 in chapter 2. Boy, this thing is finicky this morning. There we go. So chapter 2, verses 1 through 7. Woe to those who devise wickedness and work evil on their beds. When the morning dawns, they perform it, because it is in the power of their hand. They covet fields and seize them, and houses and take them away. They oppress a man. The word man is it's the word gibor. It's like a warrior, specifically. Not just a male person, but like a strong man. They oppress a man and his house, a man and his inheritance. The second time, it's just a male human. Therefore, thus says the Lord, behold, against this family I am devising disaster, from which you cannot remove your necks, and you shall not walk haughtily, for it will be a time of disaster. In that day they shall take up a taunt song against you and moan bitterly and say, we are utterly ruined. He changes the portion of my people. How he removes it from me. To an apostate he allots our fields. Therefore you will have none to cast the line by lot in the assembly of the Lord. Do not preach, thus they preach. One should not preach of such things. Disgrace will not overtake us. Should this be said, O house of Jacob? Has the Lord grown impatient? Are these his deeds? Do not my words do good to him who walks uprightly? All right. So did you see the flow? There's the introduction. He addresses somebody. Woe to you. Woe to those. And then he names the sin in verses 1 and 2. And then the coming disaster in 3 and 4. Verse 5, well, I guess verse 5 is also part of the disaster. And then 6 and 7 is the rejection of the prophecy. Do you see the flow? What kind of behaviors is Micah condemning here? Look specifically at verses 1 and 2. Stealing and oppressing people. Yeah, those are two that are listed. He says individuals, certain individuals, whoever they are lying awake at night, dreaming up ways that they can, Micah says that they can sin. They're probably not saying to themselves, how could I sin tomorrow? What they're probably doing is saying, how can I get that guy's field? How am I going to, we might call it invest. But not for Micah. I think so. Because then he says when the sun comes up, then he gets up to go do it. Yeah. So he's devising something. He's devising. And then in verse 3, therefore thus says the Lord, against this family I am devising. You were devising disaster against the Joneses, and now the Lord is devising disaster against you. Poetic justice. What? Okay, so they're laying awake at night, dreaming up ways to seize real estate and to drive people out of their homes. Now, let's think creatively. What are some ways that that they might do that? I'm just trying to get my slides caught up to where we are. You're not waiting on the slide, I am. There we go. Okay. What are some ways that individuals might seize real estate in the ancient world? Yeah, they have some sort of leverage. Yeah. A little sanctified imagination. Let's imagine that you have some sort of leverage in the ancient world and you want to take somebody's land. What are some ways you might do it? They didn't pay the rent. Okay? Of course, if they don't pay the rent, I guess you can kick them out. You're the landlord. You already have their house. But what if you're not a landlord to a renter? What if you're a banker to a homeowner? You think they didn't have banks and mortgages? Sure they did. So if you want to seize somebody's house, what can you do? You could hike those interest rates up on purpose. What else? Say again. Okay. Okay, so if this guy's going to work his field, he has to have the right tools to do it. So what if you were to maybe repossess the tools and then just wait for him to default? Mm-hmm. Yep. I think we're missing the most obvious one. Kill him. Just take it. There's a story in 2 Kings, could be 1 Kings, I think it's 2 Kings, where King Ahab wants Naboth's vineyard, and he goes home and he's like crying because he really wants this vineyard, and his wife Jezebel says, "I'll get you that vineyard," and what does she do? She goes on Craigslist, and she finds a couple of guys. Yeah, she kills them. She kills him. And then he's like, "Now you can have the vineyard." That's the most obvious. That's in the power of your hand. Repossessing because of interest rates, raising tax rates until people are just unable to survive. Accusing someone of wrongdoing. Right? Because then they get arrested, and even if it's a false accusation, even if they're exonerated, they've lost all those wages because of the time that they spent locked up. Maybe you could take advantage of someone's crisis. Somebody has a debt that they need to pay, and so they're looking, you know, they've got some land that they're looking to sell so that they can pay this debt, and you're like, "Well, I could pay you market value, but you're kind of in a pinch, so maybe I'll just give you below market value." You're taking advantage of someone's crisis. Or it could be marry into the family just to add their land to your inheritance. Okay, so there are several ways. This oracle condemns what I'm calling predatory investing and housing practices. There's something very similar in Isaiah Remember, Isaiah and Micah are contemporaries. In Isaiah 5, verse 8, he says, "Woe to those who join house to house." That is, they're collecting, they're building their portfolio. "Who add house to house, who add field to field, until there's no more room and you're made to dwell alone in the midst of the land." That is, you've bought up all the houses on the block and now nobody else can live there and you're by yourself. "The Lord of hosts has sworn in my hearing, surely many houses shall be desolate, large and beautiful houses without inhabitant." And he goes on. But I think Isaiah is condemning a similar kind of thing. Now here's the question that I'm worried about. Do predatory investing and housing practices still happen? And if so, how? You're thinking of the 2008 financial crisis? That was the first thing I thought of. Yeah, so, and those two are connected, right? You had banks that were essentially lending to people at rates that the bank knew they couldn't afford. And they did this so many times to so many people that it was like, if you have a 2x4 and you only have this much of it, this length, you can stand on it pretty easy. But the longer the length of the 2x4, the harder it is to stand on. It was like stacking these, what are called subprime mortgages, so many of them until eventually the whole thing just fell over. And you had mass foreclosures. And then all of these houses that are sitting vacant, and who goes around buying these houses? Like Alice said, private equity firms, big banks that are going around buying them up and renting them out at, again, rates that people can't afford. I think Micah would have something to say about this. He sold her a financial package that she could not afford. And he knew. Presumably he knew. Now, I don't know the situation. And in what way? So Larry's referring to the what's called the year of Jubilee. So essentially, if I'm an Israelite landowner and I need some cash or whatever, I might sell my property. But really what I'm doing is selling a certain number of harvests. Because on the year of Jubilee, whether that's 40 years away or 3 years away, at the year of Jubilee, that land becomes mine again. And so the value of the land essentially decreases the closer to the Jubilee you get because you're buying fewer and fewer harvests. The problem is we don't actually have any evidence that Israel actually did what God told them to do. Right? They're supposed to practice the Jubilee, but I don't know that we ever see them doing the Jubilee. And it sounds like Micah isn't, I mean, he doesn't address whether they practiced it or not, but what they're doing, at least in the meantime, he's not real happy with. A couple of other predatory investing housing things that I thought about. I know that people have mixed feelings about gentrification. Gentrification is essentially moving capital into a distressed area and causing property values to soar, which makes taxation, it causes the tax value to go up in that area and essentially drives the people who are in that distressed area out. It's a legal way, which everything that Micah is condemning here I think is legal. I think we're to gather that. But it is in some ways could be argued as predatory. Also, many investors will buy a home from someone when they're in a moment of crisis. And they'll say, I understand that you're getting divorced. I understand that your mother passed away or whatever, and you need to unload this house. I will buy your house from you, and I can do it in 7 days. And I'm going to give you $100,000 less than that house is worth. And the person is like, what am I supposed to do? I don't know how I feel about that. I came really close to doing that myself. Katie and I were starting to think about, like, you know, are we going to invest? And maybe we could buy a house and fix it up or whatever. And I just started to have, I started to realize that I was lying awake at night contemplating how I might get a single family home for below market value if I could just prey on someone who is in a moment of crisis. That started to really mess with me. And decided not to do it. The dastardly deed. Okay, all right. Okay, Micah soundly condemns those who do the things in verses 1 and 2. And he warns of disaster coming your way. And in verse 5, he says, therefore you'll have none to cast the lot, or none to cast the line by lot in the assembly of the Lord. Casting the line by lot, that has to do with inheritance. That is, you're not going to have any land to inherit. Poetic justice. To those who have taken away land, you're not going to have any land to inherit. You're devising plans, the Lord is devising a plan against you. All right. That's the first oracle. How are we doing? Especially if that car is sitting in a garage and doesn't have a payment on it, they're not in a pinch, right? Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Rationalize with the best of them. Well, the time's getting away from us, and we've got two more oracles. Granted, that first oracle was the biggest. But we're going to move on to chapter 3. Someday. There we go. All right. Chapter 3, verses 1 through 4. And I said, "Hear, you heads of Jacob and rulers of the house of Israel." Okay, who is he talking to? Is he talking to bankers? Is he talking to prophets? Yeah, he's talking to some sort of political authority. Could be judges, could be a king, could be city elders, something. But we're out of the realm of banking, and we're into the realm of politicking. All right, so I hear you, heads of Jacob and rulers of the house of Israel. Is it not for you to know justice? You who hate the good and love the evil, who tear the skin from off my people and their flesh from off their bones, and who eat the flesh of my people and flay their skin from off them and break their bones in pieces and chop them up like meat in a pot and flesh like in a cauldron. Then they will cry to the Lord, but he will not answer them. He will hide his face from them at that time because they have made their deeds evil. So again, we see the flow, the address, and then the sin, and then judgment, and the judgment is again poetic justice. What kind of behaviors is Micah condemning here? It sounds very, very gruesome, doesn't it? Do we think that the governors or the elders or whoever are going around literally cutting the skin off of people and breaking them up and putting them in a cauldron? Probably not. My guess is there'd be a little more on that in the Bible if that had been happening. Taking everything that they own. Okay. But we don't read that part in church. Go on. Yeah. So Scott's talking about, it's Genesis 45 to 47, somewhere in there, where famine hits, and Joseph has wisely stockpiled food ahead of time, and people come to him and they say, "We need food." And he could just give them food, but instead he decides to sell them food, and he, in exchange, takes all of their livestock. And the next year they're still hungry, and so this time he takes all of their land and their homes, and then all of their children, and then themselves as slaves, so that at the end, everything belongs to the empire. I mean, it's very much a text on what we would call totalitarianism. What are some ways that
Bible time, judges, kings, elders could abuse power to serve themselves. Because that's what this is about, right? This is about abusing power and feeding themselves with the flesh of the people. So I put in a term that I learned from James just like a week or so ago, brother-in-lawing. Are you familiar with this term? They're kind of like exchanging favors, like giving seats of power to your brother-in-law instead of to people who are actually qualified. Taking bribes would be a way to abuse power for your own gain. Heavy taxation. I mean, think about the home that the king lives in versus the home that the peasants live in, and how was that funded? It's not based on his strategic investing. He built it with tax dollars, at least in the ancient world. Forced labor. Solomon, right, enslaves his fellow Israelites in order to build his temple. Monopolizing resources like Joseph, appointing corrupt officials, brother-in-lawing, finding in favor of people who can benefit them personally, so that if it's someone who's like hearing a case at the city gate, it's not about what's right, it's about what's going to benefit the judge in the long run. This oracle condemns self-serving and greedy politicking. There it is, exploitative politicking. Ezekiel 34 is about the same kind of thing. Ezekiel is just a few years after Micah, and he uses the image of shepherds who feed themselves by eating the sheep. But a similar kind of idea. Does self-serving and exploitative politicking happen today? Okay. Maybe Micah has something to say today. Dare I ask, how? Same way it's been happening for centuries? The U.S. aid situation that Doge addressed. The first thing I wrote, policy decisions that favor campaign donors. Is that not the kind of thing? You who know justice, or it's your job to know justice, and you're disrupting justice in order to pad your own pocket. I know that this was, I don't know as much about this as I probably should, because I try to keep my head in the sand more. But I know this is one of the concerns about Elon Musk being in the position that he was in or still is in, that he would have access to all of this classified information as a private citizen, and he could use that for his own personal gain. That was the concern. Whether that happened or not, I don't know, but I know that was one of the criticisms. And it's a similar kind of using power, the position of political power in order to have personal, private gain. Oh, you're thinking like insider trading or something like that. Okay, yeah. And then the only other thing I put in, we'll squeeze in one last oracle, is using political power to retaliate against dissenting voices. You think that didn't happen in the biblical world? Think it didn't happen today? So Micah warns of disaster coming to these leaders. They have people who are coming to them for justice. They're crying out for justice, and instead what they're getting is they're being silenced, and the favor is going to the brother-in-law instead. And as a result, in verse 4, then they, the judges, will cry to the Lord, but he will not answer them. That is, the Lord is going to do to you what you have done to others. All right, last one, verse 5 and 6. I'm done with this PowerPoint. It's the same questions. Same questions. Verses 5 through 8. Thus says the Lord concerning who? The prophets who lead my people astray, who cry peace when they have something to eat, but declare war against him who puts nothing into their mouths. There's the sin. Here's the punishment. Therefore it shall be night to you without vision, and darkness to you without divination. The sun shall go down on the prophets, and the day shall be black over them. The seers shall be disgraced, and the diviners put to shame, and they shall all cover their lips, for there is no answer from God. And then there's kind of this aside. That's one of the more important verses in Micah. But as for me, I am filled with power, with the Spirit of the Lord, and with justice and might, to declare to Jacob his transgression and to Israel his sin. That is, the other prophets, they don't say hard things. They don't declare to Jacob his transgression and his sin, but I have the Spirit of the Lord, and so I'm compelled to speak things that they don't want to hear. So what kind of behaviors is the prophet condemning? In verse 5, these prophets cry peace when they have something to eat, but they declare war against him who puts nothing in their mouths. Here's a fun little fact, Bible trivia. This is good for parties and stuff if you want to pull this out. The word for eat, does anybody have a different word in verse 5? Who cry peace when they have something to bite, eat, chew, yeah, so it's not the normal word for eat. That's achal, just to have a meal. This is the word nashak. Nashak. It's the word for to nibble on something. As long as they have something to nibble, they cry peace. Also, nashak, it's the word for charge interest. Isn't that interesting? As long as they have something to nashak, they cry peace. But they will declare war against the person who doesn't pad their pocket. Okay, he's talking about prophets who say all is well when their bellies are full and their wallets are full, but they declare war on non-contributors. These are spiritual leaders and advisors whose preaching follows the money. Does that happen today? Why are you laughing, Jane? All right, greedy, manipulative spiritual leadership still happens.
When preachers refuse to say something that might upset the people, especially the people who are wealthy. I'll tell you, preachers think twice before they say something that they know is going to hurt the feelings of someone who helps the budget. Preachers that take whatever stance is going to keep the most people happy and keep the contributions flowing. Preachers who promise divine blessing for faithfulness and then say that contributions to their church are that act of faithfulness. It's what they'll call seed faith. Have you guys heard the term seed? Like giving is planting a seed? Okay. Anytime you hear that, you just throw Micah 3 at them. They're like, no. No, 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 no. Also, Christian retailers who offer products based solely on sales potential rather than theological grist. Here's what I mean by that. You can go into a Christian bookstore and know that the stuff that's on the shelf is there because the people who own it think this stuff is going to sell, even if it's not necessarily the best stuff theologically. And eventually what's going to happen is you're going to have shelves that are lined with things that people just want to hear. And then you're going to have people who have books that aren't getting published because they want to declare to Jacob his transgression and his sin, and people don't want to hear it. Very true. As the bookstore dies on the vine, it'll be less an issue. Oh, Christian music industry is a very similar way. Very similar. It's based on what are people going to listen to? That's what we'll play. It's going to be the stuff that makes me feel good. All right. This section, chapters 2 and 3, makes me feel a little helpless because we're talking about such big systemic issues. I mean, we're talking about like the 2008 financial collapse, and we're talking about gentrification and we buy ugly houses, and we're talking about brother-in-lawing and politics and all kinds of stuff that, like, I just feel like, what am I supposed to do to move the needle at all? Or am I supposed to move the needle? Micah doesn't seem to feel like he can move the needle, right? He said their wound is incurable. What am I supposed to do? If I'm a small-time farmer, I'm the little guy on the bottom of all these problems, what is an appropriate way of life? That's what we're going to talk about next week. That's what Micah gets to in chapter 6. So we're going to leapfrog to chapter 6, and then we'll go back and do chapter 4 and 5. But that's the plan. Okay. All right. Thank you, guys. I love you all. We'll see you in worship.